swings open as a recorded voice says, "The fourth round of testing has now begun." Chapter 10. They didn't wish us luck. Perhaps that is a strange thought to be having at this moment, but my mind can't seem to focus on anything else as I step from my tiny testing candidate cell onto a patch of brown grass growing up through concrete. I can barely breathe as I look at the decaying devastation around me. Steel and rock, glass and wood, buildings broken and collapsed, cars completely rusted and overturned. A layer of sooty grime covers it all. Here and there, hardier plants are fighting to get beyond the rubble, yearning toward the sun. Vines cover the wreckage of broken cars and buildings, trees that have been corrupted by the tainted earth but are determined to survive, twist through the pieces of the broken city on their way to the sky. Not too far away from where my metal box sits is what looks like a collapsed brick arch that is partially covered by dark, prickly vines. In the rising sunlight, I think I can see words etched on the brick, and I cautiously take a few steps toward it. I squint to make out the letters. CHICAOSTOCEXCHEB. Even with one letter unreadable, I now know for certain where I am. Chicago, the third city destroyed during the fourth stage of war. The first two cities had some warning, announced evacuations. Hundreds of thousands of people died, but it could have been worse, like it was here. Books tell us the attack was fast, undetected until the first bombs had been dropped. Who the enemy was who breached the country's defenses and destroyed a city unprepared has never been confirmed, although the president and his advisors believed they knew. They struck back, and the world collapsed. Wind whistles through the abandoned streets, but they aren't abandoned, not now. 58 other testing candidates are here. Some are my friends, but according to Michael, others will happily cut me down with the weapons provided for our defense just to ensure their spot in the university class. How do I find one without risking running into the others? Or the weapons they might have selected? Being forced to use the gun in my bag? Tomas said to meet him at the tallest building, but from my current vantage point, it is hard to tell what that might be. I walk back to my box and hoist myself up to the roof to get a better look. More broken concrete and twisted steel. Mountains of rubble that form the graves of the people who used to call this city home. The enormity of the destruction pulls at my heart, but I don't have time to grieve for the people who died here. I have to find Tomas. As I prepare to climb down, I spot something that catches the light above the rest of the destruction. It doesn't look like a building, but it's the tallest thing I can see from my location. Distance is hard to judge, but I'm guessing it isn't too far away. I don't know if Tomas will head there, but I have to take a shot. The transit communicator's compass is working now. So is the mapping tool that determines longitude and latitude. At least I know my coordinates. I can find my way back if I need to. Jumping down, I set off with my compass directing me north to my destination. I scramble over piles of broken rock and avoid large gaping holes in the ground, stopping every few feet to listen. Do I hear other footsteps? Is anyone else nearby? All I hear is the wind rustling the dried, claw-like leaves on a nearby tree. While my goal didn't appear to be all that far from my metal perch, The sun is much higher in the sky. When I approach, what I can now see is a grayish-looking spire shooting up from what used to be a building. How the spire survived destruction is a mystery. I wonder if Tomas can see it from his designated starting point. I sit on a fallen piece of stone and take several sips from my water bottle. The sun is hot. Sweat is dripping down my back. I need to keep hydrated if I am going to survive this test. My stomach growls, and I break off a small piece of raisin bread while I try to decide how long to wait here for Tomas. He might not see the spire. He might have decided that the tall building plan is a bust and is now trekking his way west to the fence line that was our second rendezvous point. Checking the position of the sun, I decide it must be sometime after noon. Hours have passed since I first stepped onto the city streets. While I would like to wait as long as it takes to find Tomas, I also need to find shelter when night comes. The idea of sleeping out in the open with testing candidates and whatever unknown dangers are lurking freaks me out. 1 hour. That's how long I decide I can give Tomas before I leave this spot. Then I will move on. I finish my sparse lunch and decide to explore my surroundings a bit until it is time to leave. Hoisting the bag onto my shoulder, I scramble over debris. I almost trip on a tree root and end up directly on the other side of the spire, looking at a large metal box sitting on a broken street. A testing candidate box. My heart picks up speed as I tread slowly toward the box, careful not to make any noise as I walk. It is too much to hope for that Tomas's box would be the first one I come across after leaving my own, or that he would still be in it hours after the test began. Still, I have to look. The clock inside is no longer lit. The basket of food contains only a discarded apple core and the container the crackers came in. This is definitely not Tomas's box. He wouldn't have been reckless enough to eat food that could be stored for later. And he would have stripped the cot of its sheet like I did. I'm considering adding the sheet to my inventory when I hear a stone skitter over the ground. Someone or something is outside. I freeze and hold my breath, trying to decide my next move as I hear fragments of cement crunch under a shoe. Not an animal. Definitely a person. My heartbeats count off the seconds as I listen for sounds of advance or retreat. The minutes pass. I hear nothing. I tighten and retighten my grip on the gun in my right hand and count to 100. Still nothing. Being trapped in this windowless box has me at a distinct disadvantage. Not only can I not see who is out there, but I have no method of escape if someone comes through the door. It is time to leave. Now. I peer out of the entrance of the box. The opening faces an area that at one time must have housed a building, but is now home to a few partially standing walls. A few of the walls are only 3 or 4 feet high, but one or two are taller than me. The tallest wall is probably 50 or 60 feet away. The walls could provide a place to hide from whoever is nearby, at least until I can determine whether the person means harm or not. The ground between the box and the wall is cracked, but mostly flat. If someone is waiting for me outside the box, taking them by surprise is my best chance. I position my bag's strap over my head so it is more secure, shift the weight, take a deep breath, and run. My boots pound against the hard stone ground. Somewhere off to my right, I think, I hear someone swear. My flight or my identity has taken them by surprise. If it is a friend, they would call out. When they don't, I run faster. I am about 10 feet away from my destination when I hear a high-pitched, almost musical vibrating sound. Then a thunk. Embedded in the scraggly tree trunk to my left is a crossbow quarrel. The vibrating whine sounds again. This time I flatten myself against the concrete. Seconds later, a metal quarrel hits the wall 5 feet in front of me and clatters to the ground. More swearing, definitely to my right. Whoever is shooting the quarrels either has amazing luck with the weapon or has had training with it in the past. I need to get to a safe place. Fast. Scrambling to my feet, bag banging against my hip, I speed forward and duck behind the wall as another crossbow quarrel connects with stone. There is no doubt, someone is trying to kill me. Another testing candidate? I have to believe so. A crossbow was one of the weapons in the selection room, and while I understand feeling scared and alone in this wasted city, I do not believe those are the feelings propelling this attack. Like Roman's sabotage of our group on the third exam, this attack is calculated. It is cold. It is an attempt to better the odds of making it to the university. Anger and indignation cut through my fear. Whoever this person isn't relying on their own smarts to pass this test. Michael said that killing someone isn't against the rules, but in my mind, it's a form of cheating. I'll be damned if I'm going to let a cheater win. I remember the gun in my hand, get into a crouching position, and slowly move to the right, careful to keep behind the crumbling stone. When I reach the end of the wall, I calculate my best guess as to where the quarrels were shot from, peer around the wall, and fire. The kick of the gun jolts my entire body as the sound tears through the silent city. Someone curses loudly, a male voice. I find it hard to believe my blind attack hit him. That wasn't my goal. I don't plan on surviving this test by killing the others. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go down without a fight. I shoot 3 more bullets out into the city and crouch behind the wall, listening for sounds of my attacker. The sound of feet connecting with rocks makes me hold my breath. Rocks skittering across pavement. The clang of something metal. Silence. Then the sound of heavy footsteps running, not toward my position, but away. I am safe. For now. My body shakes as anger seeps out, leaving behind hollow fear. I just shot a gun at someone. No, I wasn't trying to kill the shooter, but I could have. I could have killed someone. The fact that the person was trying to kill me can justify my behavior, but shame and horror still fill me. I realize that I am huddled up against the wall, no longer listening to the sounds of the city, and tell myself to snap out of it. There will be time enough later to worry about what I have just learned about myself. First, I need to put distance between me and this place. The gunshots will have attracted attention from anyone in the vicinity. If there are other testing candidates out there interested in taking out the competition, they might come looking for the source of the gunshots. I don't want to be here when they arrive. Listening carefully for signs of life, I peer around the wall and scan the wreckage of the city. I see no one, not near the candidate box, not on the piles of broken buildings or hiding among the branches of diseased trees. As far as I can tell, at this very moment, I am alone. While I would like nothing better than to have Tomas walking out of the city with me, I will have to make it out of here on my own. Keeping low to the ground, I check my compass and slowly head west, careful to stop every 10 or 15 feet to scan the area around me. So far, I see no one, but I know the crossbow shooter is out there somewhere. Climbing over rocks and pieces of steel makes travel slow. Eventually, I find a street that is mostly cleared of debris and pick up my pace. The street leads to a wide river of dark, swirling water. There is no need for tests. This water is not drinkable. No amount of basic purification chemicals will make it so. The street I am following arches up and over the river. There are cracks and gaping holes in the bridge. Do I try to cross here or find another way to the other side? I stow my gun in the side pocket on my bag and climb a tree on the riverbank for a better view. The river curves to the northeast. It's hard to see what lies in that direction. To the south, there is another bridge, but it too appears to be in disrepair, and who knows how long it will take me to get there or what I will encounter when I do. Scrambling back down to the ground, I decide to try to cross here. I need to put as much distance as possible between me and any unfriendly candidates. If I start to cross and find the bridge is too unsafe, I will head south and try my luck there. As I cross, I see evidence of a meager attempt to repair the bridge. Perhaps past testing candidates placed the large planks of wood and slabs of rock over gaping holes when they, too, needed to cross to the other side. Pieces of rock crumble under my boots as I pick my way to the middle of the bridge. From this vantage point, I can tell the far side of the bridge is in even worse condition. Entire sections of asphalt are gone, leaving only small strips here and there that can be navigated. Whoever attempted to patch the bridge behind me must not have wanted to go back to land for materials to repair this side. I contemplate my options. Return back the way I came to try the south bridge, or keep going and hope for the best. My current position on the bridge has me exposed. No doubt I am in view of any nearby candidate. If one has spotted me, going back will leave me open to attack. Either option holds risk. Fear of the crossbow shooter keeps my feet moving forward. I shift the bag on my shoulder as the patch of pavement I walk narrows to a mere foot in width. The dark water rushes underneath me, waiting for one misplaced footstep to carry me away. I am 20 feet from safety when I hear the now familiar vibrating sound that signals danger. There is no choice but to run, as what I can only guess is a quarrel whizzes past. There is a plunk in the water below as it is swallowed up by the current. 5 feet from safety, the piece of road I have been traveling vanishes. The vibrating sound sings again. I don't have time to think as I leap up and over the gaping hole, hoping to make it to the other side. But only the top part of me makes it onto land. The rest of me dangles in the emptiness between the ledge and the river. Between the weight of my body and my bag, I feel myself sliding backwards. I claw at the concrete and dig my fingers into the fissure in the stone, bringing my backwards movement to a halt. My arm muscles begin to tremble as I attempt to pull myself onto land. Only after several tries, I have barely moved a fraction of an inch, and my fingers are starting to lose their hold. There is nothing I can do to stop it. In a minute, I will be plunging downward toward the water. I'm bracing myself for the fall and hoping that the bank next to the river is scalable, when something clamps onto my arm and pulls my fingers loose from their tenuous grip on safety. With all the dangers around me, I know I should stay quiet. but I can't help it. I scream. Chapter 11.
It's okay, Sia. It's okay.
It takes a minute for the voice to penetrate the fear, for the realization that I am being pulled up and not pushed away to bloom into understanding. I stop fighting and allow myself to be hoisted up, up, up to the safety of land. My heart is pounding. I can hardly breathe, but I manage to croak out, "Thanks." As Tomas's face swims in front of me. His eyes are wary and filled with concern, but his tone is light when he says,
"When we get back to Tosu City, we're going to have to work on your long jump."
It's a weak joke, but it makes me smile and helps me briefly forget where I am, why I'm here. For a moment, I am safe. Then the moment disappears. Scrambling to my feet, I peer back toward the bridge, looking for signs of the crossbow shooter.
"We have to get out of here. There's someone with a crossbow looking to thin out the competition. He attacked me while I was looking for you. He must have followed me to the bridge."
Tomas's eyes narrow as he looks beyond me to the bridge. Is he looking for proof there was a shooter? Does he not trust my word? If not for my father's dreams, Roman's betrayal, and Michael's warning, I would not have believed another candidate would approach this test in such a way. Can I blame Tomas for doubting?
"Well, whoever it was must be trying to find a safer way across the river. It's amazing you made it at all. I almost lost it when I saw you jump."
He shifts the bag on his shoulder and holds out his hand. I'm about to take it when I realize mine are bleeding. Tomas notices the cuts and says,
"We'd better get those cleaned. The last thing you need is an infection. Come on, let's get out of the sun and fix you up."
We travel west for over a mile before I'm willing to stop at a waist-high pile of broken metal and rocks. They will offer some concealment while I patch up my hands and get something to eat. Now that fear no longer gnaws at my stomach, I am starved. Tomas sits next to me and says,
"I can rip my sheet into bandages if you need me to."
"Not necessary." Although I'm glad to know I was right, Tomas did strip the sheet off his bed. "I have a medical kit in here. Since I don't want to get blood all over everything in my bag, I ask Tomas to retrieve the kit and the half-full bottle of water. I wet a cotton bandage and dab at my wounds, grateful to learn that under the blood, there are just a couple of scrapes. A smear of anti-infection ointment and a few bandages later, I am ready to eat. I stow the kit back in my bag, take out an apple and offer one to Tomas. It's the least I can do after he saved my life. He grins.
"The medical kit was one of your three items, right?"
When I nod, his smile grows wider.
"I almost took one, but I figured you'd think of that. I didn't want to duplicate anything you had just in case we hooked up."
It was a risky choice, one that might not have paid off had we not found each other. But we did. Knowing he was thinking of us as a team while making his choices makes me inexplicably happy, considering the circumstances. As we eat our apples and the two cinnamon rolls Tomas pulls out of his bag, we compare equipment. I show him the water and purification chemicals, which he also figured I would take. But he did not guess my last choice. He'd been certain I would take a compass, since it was the one item almost every candidate would need on this journey. So his eyebrows rise in surprise as I pull the gun from the side pocket of my bag and admit that I already have had cause to use it.
"That was you?"
The shame I felt earlier at my actions resurfaces, and I drop my eyes so I don't see the censure that must be in Tomas's eyes. but he won't let me look away. Fingers lift my chin so I have to meet his gaze. In it, I see understanding, caring, and pride.
You did the right thing. It takes courage to defend yourself, and I'm glad you did. I can't imagine what I would do if something happened to you.
He gives me a soft smile. Then he says,
Do you want to see my three items?
A toolkit that Tomas was pleased to find also contains matches. A late 21st century map book of all 50 of the former United States containing detailed maps of the ground we will be treading. Last is a very large, very deadly-looking knife that Tomas slides out of a leather scabbard. I don't remember seeing that kind of knife, if you can call it that, among the weapons we were allowed to select, but it must have been there. Two hands can easily grasp the handle. The blade itself is at least 2 feet long. One edge is serrated on the bottom. The rest of it gleams with deadly sharpness.
I thought it would be useful in case we need to cut our way through overgrown bushes.
He slides the knife back in its scabbard and attaches it to something on his belt. As far as weapons go, it was a good choice, even if it makes me cringe. I store my belongings back in my bag and then show Tomas my brother's transit communicator and the pocket hunting knife I brought from home. Knowing we must be much better stocked for survival than most of the candidates makes me feel more confident as we set off through the wasted city to whatever lies to the west. Tomas thinks we should continue in this direction for a while before turning south, which surprises me. Aren't we traveling all the way to the fence? I ask.
Why?
To meet up with the others. You told Xandri and the others about meeting at the fence, right? Tomas stops walking.
You're the only one I told.
But I'm about to ask why, but then I think about the crossbow shooter, Rhyme's offer of corn cakes, the way Malachi was tripped by Roman when we first walked into the dining hall, and Roman's trick. It comes down to trust. Tomas trusts me, and the kindness I have seen him demonstrate over and over again since we were children makes me certain I am correct in trusting him. Still, I can't help but ask, what happens if we run into Xandri or the others along the way? Will we leave them to fend for themselves? Do we allow them to join us? Can we just walk away from people we call our friends? I see Tomas wrestling with the question as we once again begin to travel west. After a long time, he speaks.
They say we're going to be evaluated on the choices we make. I guess that's going to have to be one of them.
We walk for several more miles, rarely talking as the landscape on the horizon becomes more barren. History says that town after town once fanned out from the outer reaches of the city, that hundreds of thousands of people lived and worked in close proximity to Chicago and thrived because of the city's heartbeat. There is little evidence of that now. Whoever destroyed the city also decimated the towns surrounding it, at least the ones we might be able to see from our location. All that is left are scraps of metal, broken walls, pieces of glass, and a lot of cracked, decayed earth, signs of the destruction man can cause against his fellow man. The sun fades from the horizon and darkness begins to fall as we spot a small structure that stands amid a tall patch of weeds. A survivor of the war or something built after by one of those who escaped the destruction? Whatever the structure is, it appears to be intact. We look at each other and in that glance agree to head for the building. We could walk a little farther, but who knows if we will find another structure to camp in. The idea of staying outside, unprotected, with testing candidates and animals prowling for victims is not appealing. We are both hot and sweaty when we reach the building. The last vestiges of light are fading from the sky. The building is small and square, about 8 feet by 8 feet, with a hard concrete floor. All four walls still stand, but much of the roof is gone, leaving us with a view of the hazy sky. I'm glad there is no sign of rain. A charred area in the corner of the building suggests someone, probably a testing candidate from a previous year, lit a fire there. Tomas decides the walls provide enough cover if we would like to build a small fire. But while a fire would be comforting, neither of us wants to take the risk. In the blackness of night, any light will be seen for miles. We eat dried fruit and some bread for dinner. By the time we are finished with our meal, the light is completely gone, and though the moon is bright, I can see only the outline of the building's door, nothing else. While I am used to the dark nights of Five Lakes Colony, this blackness feels different, menacing, filled with the monsters I used to think hid under my bed. And there are monsters out there. At least one testing candidate is intent on killing. Tomas's hand finds mine in the dark, and I blink back tears of gratitude that I am not facing this blackness and fear alone.
"Why don't you go to sleep, Sia? I'll keep watch to make sure nothing happens."
I need to sleep. My body is trembling from exhaustion, but I know nightmares are waiting for me when I close my eyes, so I opt for conversation instead.
"How long do you think it will take to get back to Tosu City?"
I used the transit communicator to track the coordinates of this shack, compared them to the ones where my candidate testing box was located. Walking all day, we had traveled just under 18 miles. The enormity of the miles between us and our goal is overwhelming.
3 or 4 weeks. The farther we get from the city, the easier travel will be. If we find some kind of transportation, it'll go even faster. Just remember one thing. Your dad made it back when he was tested, Sia. We will too.
I use that thought to push worries about food and water and the actions of other candidates out of my head. With a picture of my father's smile in my mind and Tomas's fingers curled tight around mine, I slip into sleep. I wake with a start and blink up at a sky tinged with a hazy purple and pink, uncertain where I am. Then I remember. Slowly, I glance to where Tomas lies next to me. His head is cushioned on his testing bag. His breathing is slow and even. He must have fallen asleep before waking me from my watch. He didn't hear whatever it was that woke me from my sleep. The sound of a twig cracking makes my heart thunder. The wind? An animal or something more deadly? I squeeze Tomas's hand and put a finger over his lips as his eyes slowly open. His eyes widen as I point to the open door and mouth, "I heard something." Another snap, some leaves rustle, and my hand slides into the side pocket of my bag for my gun. Tomas reaches next to him for his knife. We wait in silence. If a testing candidate is nearby, they will see the building. Will they feel compelled to look inside for anything that might be useful during the test? I would. My fingers tighten their grip on the gun as I wait for a face to appear. None does. Tomas and I sit and wait. The minutes pass, and I am reminded of yesterday when I was trapped in the candidate box with someone lurking outside. At least this time I am not alone.
How long do we wait?
It feels like forever, although it is probably only 15 minutes. We have heard no other sounds. Tomas slowly gets to his feet and makes a motion to the door. He wants to take a look. I nod and quietly get to my feet. If someone is out there, they aren't expecting two of us. Step by cautious step, Tomas crosses to the door. He adjusts his grip on his knife, takes a deep breath, and walks outside. I quickly follow behind him. Nothing. We circle the small building, looking for signs someone has been here, but find only our tracks and those made by small animals. Now that I am not terrified, I find myself smiling as I study the animal prints. Fox, and maybe a rabbit. We are going to need a food source beyond the fruit and bread we have stored in our bags. I make a note to look for wires and other supplies to create traps, and follow Tomas back inside the little building to gather our things. If we are going to make it to Tosu City, we need to get moving. We eat cinnamon rolls with raisins for breakfast, and I open the first canteen of water for us to wash it down. With two of us drinking from my supply, the water will go fast, especially in this heat. While yesterday I was concerned with putting distance between us and the wrecked city, today I am focused on finding the tools we need to survive the weeks to come. We need to find water that is uncontaminated enough for my purification chemicals to make it drinkable. And we need to find it soon. As we eat breakfast, we study the Illinois page of Tomas's map book. Though most of the cities, towns, and roads have been eaten away by war and time, we are hoping that at least a few of the lakes and rivers have remained constant. We decide to head toward a river that looks like the best option and punch the coordinates into the transit communicator. According to the device, the river is 15 miles to the southwest. Bags on our shoulders, we start walking, using the compass as our guide. All around us is flat, brittle land, a casualty of the biological weapons used on the city and the nearby towns. So different from the hilly part of the country I grew up in. As we walk, we take sips of water, trying to replace the liquid the sun is leaching out of us, and talk of unimportant things. Our favorite childhood games, the songs our mothers sang us to sleep with, our favorite foods. Tomas is fond of honey-glazed carrots. I love fresh raspberries. We talk about celebrating our testing success with both. After several hours of walking, we find a grove of squat trees in which to rest. Just as Tomas dumps his bag, I give a shout of joy. Growing near the trunks of the trees are dozens of small white flowers with spiky petals reaching up to the sky. Clover. My father says it's one of the few plants that never had trouble growing, no matter the condition of the soil. When I was little, my mother often served clover salad when other foods were scarce. Funny how some things never change. Tomas and I strip the ground bare of the small white plants, divide them into two piles, and sit in the shade, eating the fresh flowers and green stems with our bread and fruit. We leave the roots so the flowers will grow again. Perhaps for the testing candidates who come this way next year. The afternoon sun is brutal as it bakes the ground beneath my feet. Sweat pours from our bodies. The dirt that swirls in the air adheres to our wet, sticky skin. Between us, we have emptied the first canteen and have opened the second. We need to find a water supply. The device in my hand tells me we still have 2 miles until we arrive at what we hope is a river. It is late afternoon when we reach our destination, a dry riverbed. We check the map twice to make sure this is the right location. There is no doubt. An event, probably an earthquake, shifted the land and emptied the river between the time the map was created and now. And while it isn't surprising, I can't help the surge of disappointment that is rapidly followed by fear. I shove the fear aside and concentrate on solving the problem. Because isn't that what the testing is about? Finding those who can solve the problem even when put under great stress? The testing officials want candidates to succeed. There will be water somewhere. We just have to be smart enough and patient enough to find it. I see a small hill to our southwest and say, "Well, the water from the river had to go somewhere. Why don't we see if we can spot it from up there?" Tomas stows the map book into his bag and nods.
"Sounds good to me."
The hill is farther and taller than it looks. The sun is starting to lose its luster when we reach the top. One look at the landscape below us makes me want to cry. More cracked grayish-brown earth. More scraggly, diseased-looking trees with dry, parched leaves. More emptiness. Except off in the distance, I squint into the setting sun. Yes, there, far to our right, is a patch of green. Green that can only be created by thriving plants. And for plants to thrive, they have to have water. With a wide smile, Tomas takes my hand and we set off at a quick pace toward the greenery. It occurs to me as we walk that while our view from the top of the hill was helpful, it might have also put us in danger. Anyone in the vicinity looking our way will have seen us. I mention my worries to Tomas, but there isn't much we can do now. There is no place to take cover in this empty landscape. We have to keep moving forward and hope for the best. The closer Tomas and I get to the greenery, the edgier I feel. The proximity of the hill to the greenery and the possible water source we spotted start to feel too much like coincidence, because this part of the country has not been officially revitalized. There is the impression it's been left untouched by the United Commonwealth's government staff. But that isn't necessarily the case. Dr. Barnes and his testing officials want to see how we think, how we identify and deal with problems. It only makes sense that they would set up smaller tests within the larger one. That they would not be willing to leave the obstacles we face up to chance. As we approach the green patch, I begin to feel certain that this oasis is another kind of test. The perfect oval the grass grows in, the shimmer of a clear, clean, uncontaminated pond that rests in the center. Two trees filled with healthy leaves stand guard on either side. The entire area is only about 20 feet wide and half as long. There is no doubt, this small patch of paradise is man-made. Tomas picks up his pace at the sight of the water, but stops when he notices I am no longer beside him.
"What's wrong, Sia?"
I explain my suspicions, and his forehead wrinkles in thought. He looks at the pond with longing and says,
"They know we need water. It only makes sense that they've added some water sources out here in order to keep us alive. Otherwise, none of us would pass the damn test. Then where would they be?"
Tomas has a good point, but he wasn't the one who listened as Dr. Barnes rationalized Rhyme's death. He didn't see Malachi die. If I hadn't, maybe I would believe this spot is a gift from the testers. Instead, I see it as a trap. "Let's walk around the grass line and take a look just to be sure." Tomas wants to argue. I can see it in the set of his jaw. It's the same reaction he had in class when a fellow student or our teacher was wrong. Instead of arguing with him, I walk up to the vibrant green grass, careful not to disturb it with my foot. Flowers grow near the edge of the pond, filling the air with their sweet fragrance. The trees are tall and straight and provide shelter from the sunshine. It's a perfect spot to rest and be restored from travel. In this place where nothing is perfect, is it a wonder that I refuse to trust it?
It looks okay to me,
Tomas says from the other side of the oasis. Just a few more minutes, please, I yell. I turn my back on him, hoping this will end the discussion. My gut tells me to get the hell away from this place, but I have to convince Tomas. He has always been so good, so kind to others, especially those who are sad or in distress. It is no wonder he expects the government that brought us here to be helpful too. With this being the only water source we've seen since the contaminated river yesterday, I don't blame him for being tempted. If only there was another water source nearby. There's another hill not too far away. Maybe I'll see something if I take a look. I'll be right back. Stay there, I say, and I set off for the hill. My legs are tired, but I move fast. I'm at the top of the hill in less than 5 minutes, and though I am breathless, laugh when I see it. Not too far away, maybe another 100 yards or so, is a small river. The water doesn't gleam and the plant life surrounding it isn't lush, but I know by the path it sculpts through the ground that it is natural. Water. Contaminated? Probably, but I have my kit to deal with that. For the first time today, I feel a sense of relief. Then, the world explodes.
Chapter 12. Surprise and the force of the blast knock me off balance. I hit the ground and roll, then scramble up to my feet, trying to understand what just happened. The ringing in my ears, the gaping hole where the oasis used to stand. Tomas nearby on the hard, cracked earth lying completely still. Choking back a sob, I fly down the hill to where Tomas is sprawled on his back, eyes closed. I fear the worst, that once again I will hold the hand of someone from home as he slips from the world, leaving me behind. Then I see the steady rise and fall of his chest and sag with relief. He's alive. However the trap was sprung, Tomas was not in the middle of it when it happened. Otherwise he, like the trees, flowers, and water, would be gone. Just thinking of a world without his strong, steady presence is enough to bring me to my knees. Still, he is not conscious, which isn't good. I sit on the ground next to him and gently check the back of his head for swelling that would indicate a concussion or something worse. I am relieved to find nothing. Then I notice the blood pooling on the ground next to his right hip and the inch-thick branch protruding from his body. I stamp down my tears. Crying won't help Tomas, so I have to decide what will. Dr. Flint always says you aren't supposed to move someone with a head wound, but I don't have a choice. I have to stop the blood seeping into the cracked soil. Carefully, I shift Tomas onto his side. The jagged wood is buried deep in Tomas's backside. The explosion and the impact against the ground must have created enough force for the branch to impale him. Taking a deep breath, I get a good grip on the tree branch and pull. The edges of the wood catch on Tomas's flesh. He starts to groan and wince as I work the wood back and forth in the wound to remove it. The flow of blood increases as the wood slides free from Tomas's body. I rip a strip of fabric off my cot sheet, press it against the wound, and hold it there with one hand while my other searches for the medical kit. The disinfecting ointment will come in handy. The needle and thread might, too, if I can get up the nerve to use them. I'm starting to roll Tomas onto his belly when he moans again. His gray eyes blink open.
What happened?
Hearing his voice, seeing him awake, makes me smile, even as it unlocks a flood of tears.
The oasis blew up, I tell him, wiping tears with the back of my dirt-streaked hand. You got impaled by a tree branch. I removed it, but the wound is bleeding pretty bad. Don't worry, I say, feigning more confidence than I feel. I'll have you fixed in no time. Only...
His eyes narrow.
Only what?
I feel the blush heating my cheeks even before I say, You're going to have to remove your pants for me to do it. The grin he gives me is wicked, and more than a little sexy, but quickly turns to a frown as he struggles to unfasten his pants and push them down. The wound is still bleeding, but not near as bad as it was. The puncture is over an inch in diameter, and judging by the blood on the stick, at least 3 inches deep. The area around the wound is a mangled mess of blood and tissue. An injury like this has to hurt like hell, and I have no idea how to fix it. Over the years, Dr. Flint closed several of my brother's cuts, but those didn't look like this. Those had been tears in the flesh, which could only be brought together using a needle and thread. This is a gaping hole. Still, I have to do something. I dig several pain tablets out of the bag and prop Tomas up so he can swallow them. Then I clean the wound as best I can with water. Wiped free of blood and dirt, the injury looks even worse. I was right. There is no way I can sew this wound shut. Which leaves me with only one idea. Just thinking about it makes me want to scream, but I have no choice. Blood is still flowing from the gap in his flesh. If it doesn't stop soon, Tomas won't be able to travel. He won't finish the test, and neither will I, since I could never leave knowing he'd most likely die out here, injured and alone. Gathering bits of dried grass and pieces of wood into a pile, I light them with one of Tomas's matches. Once the fire is started, I pull the hunting knife out of my pocket. In addition to the knife and screwdriver, there is a nail file, a wood saw, a hook, and several other metal gadgets I've never found a use for, until now. I select the tool that is about 1.5 inches long, less than 1/2 inch wide, and flat on top. There is a hooked thing near the middle my father said he used as a child to open bottles. But we don't have those kinds of bottles in Five Lakes, so I can only imagine how that works. It isn't the bottle opener I'm interested in, but the flat, unsharpened surface near the top. Now I just need to muster the courage to go through with my plan. As the small fire crackles, I do something I've seen Dr. Flint do when the patient is conscious during a particularly unpleasant treatment. I hand Tomas his cot sheet to bite down on, then hold the bottle opener over the flames and wait for it to turn red. When it does, I ask Tomas to look away. Before I can lose my nerve, I pull the hot metal out of the flame and apply it to the wound. Tomas screams into the sheet and bucks in pain. The sounds of his agony are muffled and my eyes fill with tears. But I have to keep working. I put the tool back into the flames with one hand while I wipe the blood from the wound and hold Tomas's legs down with the other. When the metal is once again hot, I place it against his flesh. A coppery, sulfurous odor makes me gag. The smell of burning skin. Tears run down my face. My chest tightens so I can barely breathe. Tomas's muted screams rip through my heart as I heat the metal and apply it to the wound again and again, until finally the burned tissue fuses together and the bleeding is stopped. My hands shake as I use our precious water to dab clean the wound. Then I spread ointment on the area, bandage it, and help Tomas struggle into his pants. I fervently hope the bleeding is stopped for good, because I don't think I can do that again. Tomas's eyes are glazed and his forehead coated with sweat as he gives me a weak smile.
"I barely felt a thing," he lies.
I go to place a kiss on his cheek, only he turns his head and the kiss lands on the corner of his mouth. Time stops as we stare at each other. Then, very slowly, Tomas leans forward and kisses me again. The kiss is light as a feather, but I feel it all the way down in my stomach. I've been kissed by boys before. I'm young for my class, but I'm not that young. None of those kisses made me feel the way this one does. Maybe because of the fear and adrenaline I've been operating under, or because I don't understand why Tomas kissed me. Gratitude? Or something more? Something I have felt building since we danced last year and have been too scared to believe is real. Confused by emotions I don't want to analyze, I turn away and start jamming supplies back in my bag. It's going to get dark soon. When I was on top of the hill, I saw a stream. It's not too far away. Do you think you can walk, or should we set up camp here? There's probably enough light for me to make it to the stream, fill up our canteens, and come back. I know I'm rambling, but can't seem to stop myself. He shakes his head and slowly gets to his knees.
If your crossbow friend heard the explosion, he might come looking for us. We should put some distance between us and here before we lose light.
With everything else going on, I'd forgotten about the other testing candidates. The explosion will have drawn attention. If the crossbow shooter heard the explosion, he might assume whoever was caught in it is dead. Unless he heard Tomas's screams during my treatment. Either way, Tomas is right. We need to clear out. I help Tomas to his feet and loop his arm around my shoulders so I can lend him support. He is almost a head taller than me, but we manage to make it work. It's slow going up the hill, though, and both of us are panting hard when we reach the top. Finally, the pain medication is starting to take hold, and Tomas is able to walk a little faster as we go down the other side. In the graying light, I spot a clump of shoulder-high bushes, thick with gray leaves, and head toward them. The cluster of bushes is dense, but after breaking off a few lower branches, I wriggle underneath the bush closest to the stream and find a small area that we can camp in. I ask Tomas for his scary-looking knife and use it to clear a bit more space for us. Then I spread Tomas's sheet on the ground and hold branches out of the way for him as he climbs inside. Tomas is asleep almost before I can tell him I'm going to get water, which is going to be tricky since the sun is setting fast. I grab the 3 empty water containers and my bag of purification chemicals and scoot through the underbrush to the stream. Testing water for drinkability isn't difficult, but it does require time and light. With the last canteen of water almost at empty and the sun fading, I'm short on both, but I have to try. If Tomas develops an infection in the middle of the night, the last thing I want to be is short of water. The tests for most contaminants are pretty basic. You fill a cup with water and then add drops of a variety of liquid chemicals that react to contamination. The small sample of water will turn either red, blue, yellow, or green to indicate a specific contaminant. Sometimes the color can be very faint. You have to be able to spot the subtle shifts in color in order to add the correct counteracting chemicals to make the water drinkable. The trick is to add only the chemicals necessary to counteract the contamination. If you add anything that doesn't belong, you could end up poisoning the water. It won't kill you, but it can make you really sick. Something I really would like to avoid. After setting out my chemicals, I use one of the clear plastic water containers from our testing box baskets and fill it with a half inch of water. I put a drop of the first chemical in and swirl the water around. If the water contains the bioengineered version of cyanide used in many of the Stage 4 bombings, the liquid will turn red. After several minutes of swirling, I am certain the water is free of that contaminant and move on to the next. I make it through the first three tests without a color change, but the fourth, for a chemical cooked up by the Asian Alliance that causes the cardiovascular system to overload, turns the water a vibrant purple, unmistakable even in the last vestiges of sunlight. I empty out the test bottle, refill the three containers, and then add the counteracting chemicals to them. It will take at least an hour for the chemicals to counteract the contamination. In the morning, I will retest a capful of the water to verify its purity before we drink. For now, I crawl back through the underbrush with my water containers, eat a few pieces of dried apple, and curl up next to Tomas on the sheet. While I try hard to stay awake, I can't help the exhaustion of the day pulling me into sleep. The sound of a bird singing greets me in the morning. For a moment, snuggled warm in the sheet, I think I am sleeping in front of the hearth at home after being chased from my room by my brother's snoring. Then I realize that something behind me is moving and remember where I am. My eyes fly open to find Tomas's clear gray ones staring down at me.
"Good morning," he says with a soft smile. "I didn't mean to wake you."
I wasn't supposed to fall asleep. And I'm annoyed with myself because I did. So much for keeping watch for the crossbow shooter. If he had come across us in the night, we would both be dead. Stupid. Only luck kept us alive. Tomas doesn't seem concerned, but he keeps his voice low as he says,
"We're pretty well hidden here. I woke up a while ago and took a look around. If our fellow candidates have come by, I haven't seen any sign of them."
"Don't you think that's strange?" I ask. "That we haven't seen any of the other candidates?"
"I don't think so. The map they showed us at the testing center made it look like the fence lines around here were at least 20 miles apart. That means there's room for us all to spread out, at least at first."
He reaches into his bag and pulls out his map book and flips to the page for Kansas.
"If I remember correctly, the fence lines narrow near the end, around here."
He points to a spot a fair distance from the city that was once called Wichita.
"I'm guessing the testing officials want to draw us together at that point to see how we respond."
Another test within a test, like yesterday.
"Yeah, and look how well that turned out."
Tomas's eyes flash with anger, an emotion I have never seen from him. He's normally so calm and logical, but his voice is loud and tight as he says,
"I almost got us blown to pieces on that one because I couldn't believe you might be right, that the one hopeful thing we'd seen since starting this test was something designed to kill us. I kept telling myself you were wrong and I was right. I mean, why the hell would the testing officials bring us all here just to kill us? It doesn't make any sense."
His fists are clenched, and I can see confusion and anger in his eyes as he demands an answer. Only I don't have one. Not really. so I take Tomas's dirt-streaked hand and hold it because I feel as lost as he does. We sit hand in hand for several minutes before Tomas smiles at me, flashing the familiar dimple.
Well, you were wrong about one thing. I'm definitely not the smartest kid from our class, Sia. Although, I guess I was pretty smart about teaming up with you. What other girl would have been willing to fix my ass after I got myself blown up?
Are you kidding? I turn away and busy myself with pulling the sack of dried fruit out of my bag so he can't see the heat flooding my cheeks. Almost every unmarried girl in Five Lakes Colony would have volunteered to patch you up, especially if you thanked her with a kiss.
Sia.
I turn and Tomas's eyes find mine. The humor in them is gone, leaving something more compelling in its place.
If another girl had helped me, I wouldn't have kissed her.
The words hang between us. Deep inside, I feel something shift and click into place. Then the humor is back as he says,
"Come on, we should start walking. Tosu City is still a long ways off."
Before we leave, I test the water I treated yesterday, grateful to have something purposeful to do instead of obsessing about Tomas's words. Was he saying I was special to him, or just flattering me? Considering all the girls back home who practically threw themselves in his path, I find it hard to believe he ever really thought of me in that way. And yet, I think back to that dance and to the moments last year when I caught him watching me across the classroom. Perhaps there has been something between us all along. The water test comes back clean. Tomas and I take the opportunity to drink our fill and even wash the grime of travel from our hands and faces before refilling the containers from the stream and treating them. We eat a breakfast of crackers, apples, and some red clover we find growing next to our grove of bushes. Then, after I check Tomas's wound and apply more ointment to it, we set off to the southwest. The day is cooler. I think storms might be on the way, but the lack of extreme heat makes travel easier. Our progress is marked not only by the change of our coordinates on the transit communicator, but also by the changing of the scenery. The flat, cracked earth, with only small patches of plant life and angry-looking trees, starts to give way to more hills, trees that are not quite healthy-looking but not as black and twisted, and far more plants. More than once, I make Tomas stop as I spot wild carrots, hollyhock, and milkweed. We'll have to light a fire to boil the milkweed, which I'm not sure we'll have time for, but I gather it just in case. Our current food supply will last only another 2 or 3 days. We'll need all the food we can find. We also begin to see more signs of birds, like the one that awakened me this morning with its singing, and other game. Tomas spots deer, fox, and rabbit tracks, along with larger prints of animals we can't put names to. We'll have to start hunting if we hope to stay strong enough to make it to the end of the test. But for now, we walk. While the miles pass, we comment on the buildings we are now seeing. There aren't many, but a few here and there, some with only partially standing walls, others that look more intact. As night starts to descend, we decide to head toward a group of one-story structures that look like they might be in decent repair. Perhaps whoever once lived in these houses has left behind something we can use to travel faster. If not, we might find other things, like wire for animal traps, that will help us survive. An animal family had taken up residence in the first house.
There are tracks, claw marks, and droppings left behind that look fresh enough to make us rethink entering. The next house looks on the verge of collapse, but a small storage building behind it appears to be sound, so we venture inside. The last streams of sunlight shine through a window long devoid of its glass, which helps us to see. The dust and moldy smell make me sneeze. There's a rotting bench on one side of the small rectangular room. On the other side is what could have once been a tractor. The rust and the lack of wheels or a motor make it hard to tell for sure. I shift a large sheet of decaying wood that is propped against the back wall and smile. Behind the wood is an old wagon-like cart. The wooden cart itself is rotted and has a chunk of wood missing from one side, but there are two wheels at the bottom, and both appear to be salvageable. Tomas gets out his toolkit and helps me detach the wheels. They are heavy, coated with a thick layer of cobwebs and grime, but they give me hope. If I can find more materials, I might be able to build something to help us travel faster. Several more houses yield us a small pot, a skillet, and some nuts and bolts that were attached to some rotting cupboards. Not a lot, but more than we had when we started. We make camp for the night, eat two of our apples and the last of our bread, and fall asleep hopeful that we will find more treasures tomorrow. The next day, a few miles away, we find a cluster of several dozen buildings, these made of mostly bricks and mortar, that have stood the test of time and weather. The way they are situated, I can only guess they once formed the center of a town, much like Five Lakes Square. We search building by building. Bits of wire disappear into our bags. A wrench. Not much else. We are about to enter the last building when Tomas points to the ground nearby. A partial boot print. My heart catches. Another testing candidate? We have to assume so. My first instinct is to flee, to run as far and as fast as we can. But Tomas wants to enter. If there is another candidate nearby, it would be best to know who it is and what their intentions are. We don't want them catching us off guard. It's hard to deny Tomas's logic. The idea of an unknown person lurking nearby, waiting for us to let down our guard, gives me a chill. Swallowing hard, I slide the gun out of my bag and follow Tomas inside and into chaos. Several small, furry animals jump off a rickety table and go racing across the room toward a hole in the wall. With my nerves taut and fear pulsing through my veins, I don't think. I just react. Bang, bang, bang. Two of the white animals drop before the rest make it to safety. Then I come to my senses and realize that if someone is nearby, I have just alerted them to our presence. I start to apologize, but Tomas just laughs.
Don't apologize. If someone is around, they're probably running as far as they can away from whoever has the gun. And if they knew you could shoot like that, they would run even faster.
He tells me to guard the front door while he checks the rest of the building. After a few minutes, I hear him let out a loud shout. At first, I think he's encountered whoever made the footprint. But then I hear the happiness in his voice as he yells for me to join him. He's got a surprise. And what a surprise! In what must have once been a vehicle storage unit are two bicycles. Tomas says he found them lying under a sheet of plastic in the back corner. The room is dark. One bicycle is missing the back tire. The other's chain and pedals have seen better days.